Okay, well, as you've heard from Charmaine, we're on to a new series this week, and after 2 months or so, I think it's been in the book of Proverbs, our thoughts now turn towards Easter. So in the next 4 weeks, we're going to be taking a look at the story of Jesus' betrayal and his trial as we see it written down in Luke's Gospel. And I guess to many of us, these are going to be pretty familiar words. The chances are you'll have heard many sermons on them. And ironically, that's probably in stark contrast to Proverbs, where you may not have heard it preached on at all until these last few weeks. And the danger with familiarity, of course, is that it may just be a bit difficult to see things in a fresh light. So, you know, it's a bit like your favourite film, where you know the specific scenes that you like, or the song, where there's one verse or chorus that stands out. You may still really love the film or the song, but there's a tendency always to see it through the same sort of pair of spectacles. And as far as today's passage goes, there's a double danger, because it's not just at Easter you'll have heard it read. I guess pretty much at every communion service you've been to, you'll probably have heard those words said as well. So with this in mind, I thought it'd be good just to take a moment at the start of this series to suggest a couple of things that might help us to see the Easter story through fresh eyes. Firstly, and probably most importantly, we need to remember that the Easter story is an amazing story. And like any epic story, there are a lot of different angles to it. So, you know, just look at all the best films. There are really limitless times that you can see them, because each time you're able to see something a little bit different that you hadn't seen before. So whether it's watching the reactions of different characters or seeing a new slant on the message that the writer's communicating, there's always something more to discover in it. So that's the first thing. But then secondly, the other thing I'd say about the Easter story is take a good look at the details. Now, that's not something that's very easy for me, because I tend to be a sort of big picture person. So I'm not always great at spotting the little things. You can ask my wife that. She'll certainly tell you that's true. But what I've discovered over the years, as I've looked at the Easter story, is that there are incredible riches that actually you may well miss on the first read through. So, for example, something I just noticed the other day as I was preparing this, the passage we just read on the Last Supper, if you had a few chapters on into Luke 24, what you'll see there is the story of the risen Jesus on the Emmaus Road. And he's talking to two disciples, and they talk with him, and they encourage him to stay and eat. And then verse 30, what we read is, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. So pretty well the same words are used there as they are in chapter 22 that we read just a few minutes ago. So Jesus uses what he did at the Last Supper to help those two disciples recognize him, when up until that point, his true identity had been hidden. So that's one example. Another one concerns places. The two most notable places that I've seen, certainly the Mount of Olives and the Temple. Because there's constant reference to them. When you look for it, as you read through the Easter story, there's just constant reference. And it looks like they're far more than just a passing note as to where a particular incident took place. They mean something. And the conclusion I've come to as I've looked at these sort of details over the years is that Jesus' death and resurrection doesn't just fulfill the many prophecies that there are in the Old Testament. The events surrounding his death and resurrection are also prophetic in and of themselves as to what will happen in the future. You know, even the setting of the story before Luke 22 is Luke 21, and Luke 21 is all about judgment and signs of the kingdom coming. And if you flick back a few chapters from there as well, you'll see that it's full of parables and narratives on a similar theme. So the point is that these details are significant. You may well struggle to piece them all together, but actually that doesn't matter if you can't work out all the answers. That's not actually the most important thing. I came to Christ not because I got everything worked out. I came to Christ because I realized I couldn't work everything out. I didn't have all the answers. And yet, as I looked at Jesus, I realized that here was a guy who clearly had a far better idea of the answers than I did. So as we see these details, we can sense that they weave together to form an amazing tapestry. We may not understand every nuance, but we can know that something very special is going on. And as we see that, our faith and our trust in Jesus should soar. So I hope that's helpful as we come to this new series, and I hope it's an encouragement to come with a fresh sense of anticipation of what lies ahead. So moving on to today's passage, what's the main story? Well, we're told right at the beginning, verse 7, it's the day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So of course this takes us back to Egypt, all the way back to Exodus, the second book of the Bible. And in chapter 12 of Exodus, we're told how the Israelite community had to sacrifice a lamb and daub the blood on their door frames so that they would remain safe while all the Egyptian households lost their firstborn of both animals and people. And we're told there that this was a judgment on all the gods of Egypt. So straight away, we've got a pointer to the fact that this is no ordinary day. And Jesus chooses his two main men, Peter and John, to go and make preparations for the Passover meal. And then what happens is he goes on to spell in quite some detail exactly what they've got to do. Now, I don't know about you, but when I used to read those instructions in verses 10 to 13, I thought, wow, you know, how amazing Jesus was able to predict all those things in advance. But actually the passage makes no mention whatsoever of whether this was divine foreknowledge or whether he'd just sort of gone ahead and sort of arranged it or sent a message or something. That's not the point that's being made. The key thing to note is that all of these details that he mentions, they seem to be important. So something really significant is about to take place. And if you've got time later, you may actually want to compare this passage with what you see in Luke 19, where Jesus gives instructions to disciples there. And there's a lot of similarities between those two passages. So clearly, it is a crucial moment. And that's emphasized even more when we're told in verse 14, when the hour came. So what was the significance of this hour? Well, it's spelled out in verses 15 to 20. Verse 15, Jesus is going to suffer. Verses 19 to 20, his body's going to be broken and his blood's going to be poured out. In other words, he's going to die. And then there's one other phrase which I just want to mention in verses 19 and 20 to pick out. And it's the phrase, for you, which is repeated for emphasis. So this is no futile death. It's not an accident. In the same way that the Passover lamb was sacrificed in Egypt so that the Israelites would escape judgment, Jesus is sacrificing himself so that his disciples would escape judgment. And of course, the rest of the Bible makes it clear that this sacrifice wasn't just for those first disciples. It's for any of us who look to Jesus and trust him for their salvation. So that's the claim here. Jesus wasn't just a teacher and a good man. He's the Passover lamb, sacrificed for our sin and for the sin of the world. And he invites us to share in that sacrifice and to share in his kingdom. So that's a pretty significant event by anybody's standards. I don't know what moments stick in your mind, defining moments in your lifetime that stick most in your memory. If you're a Brit of my age, you'll almost certainly remember what you were doing when Princess Diana died, for example. Or on a world scale, you may think of the Berlin Wall coming down or 9/11, perhaps more recently. In fact, the thing I remember about 9/11 wasn't actually the day itself. It was actually the Friday afterwards when, I don't know whether you remember, but at 11 o'clock everybody was going to observe a 2-minute silence. And I was working at All Souls here at the time. And so we thought, well, we'd gather as a staff. There weren't many people in on a Friday, but we thought we'd gather as a staff here for 11 o'clock. And so we put a note on the door outside saying that if anybody wanted to join us, then they'd be welcome. And I say it was pretty well a skeleton staff on Friday. All the ministers were off. So it elates me to be the person just to sort of, you know, lead this, which I thought, well, that's okay. It's only a few staff. So we started gathering about 5 to 11 and just a few of us here at the front. Then it got to about 10:59 and we couldn't believe it because people literally poured in from everywhere, absolutely everywhere. We had no chance whatsoever of starting 11 o'clock. They were still pouring in about 2 or 3 minutes past 11. And the thing was, it was just absolutely staggering the impact that that event had in 9/11. You probably can all remember it. So, you know, these are major days, these sort of things, and you feel the weight of them at the time. And yet, on a cosmic scale, they pale into insignificance with what went on in the upper room that night. So, you know, I guess that makes it all the more remarkable when you look at the disciples' reaction that we'll come on to now, because it appears they completely missed the point of what was going on. They just didn't get the significance. So the first bit of that you read in verse 23, I think we can understand that. You know, Jesus is going to be betrayed. It's one of us. You know, who is it? You can understand why they focus on that. But then, verse 24, we're told they started arguing about who was going to be the greatest. And if you check the other Gospels, it looks like this has been a debate that's been running on for quite a while. So it's actually quite staggering to think that even though Jesus has already taken them to task for it, this argument's still grumbling on at this most significant of times. And then when Jesus has a serious warning for all of them and asks Peter to strengthen the brothers, Peter actually totally misses this aspect of it. And instead, he picks up on the fact that Jesus implies that Peter is going to fall away. And of course, Peter insists that he won't. And then finally, when Jesus gives his last instruction in highly figurative language, all the disciples can say is, here's two swords. Just showing they've completely and utterly missed the point again. So what's clear is there's massive confusion in the minds of the disciples here. And what's also clear at this pivotal point in history is that the disciples were so bogged down in the here and now, in the trials and tribulations of the day, their human ambition, their boasting, their conceit, their selfishness, that they just couldn't see the wood from the trees. And of course that begs the obvious question, is that true of us too? Are we so bogged down with the here and now, the struggles of the day, and our own selfish ambition, that we miss what's really important? Do we want Jesus to serve our own agenda rather than us to serve his? And when he speaks to us, do we just completely miss the point because we're so obsessed with the affairs of the world that we simply see things from entirely the wrong perspective? And of course, if we're honest, there's really only one answer we can give. The answer's yes. If not all the time, at least for a fair old bit of it. So we shouldn't be standing on the outside of this story, having a laugh at the disciples as to how stupid they were. We're still pretty much the same. Even though we've got the benefit of hindsight, and we've got the record of the cross, the resurrection, and the ascension, and so on to help us. So are there, just to close, are there any clues in this passage from what Jesus says that can help us be less like this? Are there things that we need to recognize which can help us be more the people that Jesus wants us to be? Well, yes, there are. And I want to just mention a couple of things before we close. Firstly, we need to recognize that Jesus says the life of the disciple is going to be tough. Just have another look back at verses 31 and 32 when Jesus is talking to Peter. I don't want to go into too much detail on the story of Peter's denial, as we'll pick up on it again in a couple of weeks' time. But it's fascinating to have a close look at Jesus' words, because the natural assumption is that he's speaking about just Peter. But he's not. He's not. Verse 31 says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat. So all the disciples are actually in view. Sure, he's talking to Peter using the name Simon, but he says that all of the disciples are under attack from Satan. It doesn't just apply to Peter. Although we then get the distraction, if you like, of Peter protesting that he won't deny Jesus, then verses 35 to 37, they pick up on the same theme. It's almost like he's saying the honeymoon period is over. The bridegroom's going away. The hard yards are around the corner. That seems to be the message that Jesus is wanting to convey to the disciples. So don't let anyone sell you the lie that if you're a Christian, your life will all be plain sailing, because it won't be. That's not what the Bible says at all. And it's one of the worst lies out there which can be sold to people when they become a Christian. Why? Because when things start to go wrong, they start to think that the Christian message is false. And so they give up. Jesus actually is quoted as saying it more plainly in John's Gospel. If you looked up chapter 16, verse 33, you read this. He says, in this world, you will have trouble. It's the normal Christian experience. And he wants us to remember that so that it shouldn't take us by surprise. So that's the first thing to recognize. But then the other thing to remember is that that's not the whole of the story. Because John 16, verse 33 goes on to say, but take heart, I've overcome the world. And of course, it's fair to say that we will see some evidence of Jesus overcoming the world in this age. For example, you just move a few chapters on to the end of Luke's Gospel, and the disciples are told they'd be clothed with power from on high. So we will see some evidence for Jesus' claim there in the here and now. But the most obvious way in which we're going to see his words come to fruition is not in the here and now. It's in the future, when he brings this age to an end and when his kingdom comes in all its fullness. And as we look back again at Luke 22, we see that his words are actually full of this future promise. So take verses 16 to 18, for example, the Passover meal. We can see there it's a foretaste. It's a foretaste of the kingdom of God. And then verses 29 to 30, and amongst all those other words for the disciples, we're told that actually they're going to sit on thrones and judge the 12 tribes of Israel. So there's rich promises there. But it isn't just the promises themselves that hit home. What's just as important is the certainty with which they're all said. Take verse 37, for example. And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. So yes, there was confusion and chaos all around. But while this was going on, Jesus was totally in control. Why? Because he knew the future. When Jesus was eating that Last Supper, his focus wasn't actually really on his death as such. It was actually on what his death would achieve. It was on the coming of the kingdom of God and of life in all its fullness. He wants his disciples to know the certainty of this, and the reason it's recorded here is so that we can know the certainty of this. So as we head out of here, back to the workplace, back home, or wherever, surely one of the best ways of living for Jesus in the present is to remind ourselves of this future. The glory of what's to come is real. And if we can just hold on to that truth as we go about our daily lives, it should help to put whatever struggles we may be facing today into their proper perspective.